Retina Rounds podcast number 20. The field of retina is filled with outstanding surgeons, innovative clinician scientists, and inspiring educators. Occasionally, we come across individuals who can do it all and at the highest level. In today's episode, Retina Rounds is excited to welcome just such an individual, Dr. Ehsan Rahimi. Dr. Rahimi is Chief of Retina at Palo Alto Medical Foundation and Adjunct Associate Clinical Professor of Ophthalmology at Stanford University. He's known as an outstanding surgeon, a perceptive clinician, a prolific and creative researcher, and a highly sought-after industry collaborator. In today's episode, Dr. Rahimi shares his secrets for success and provides numerous pearls for ophthalmic surgeons in training and beyond. Let's check it out. Well, welcome everybody to the Retina Rounds podcast. Today we have a very special guest, a longtime friend of mine, and really a true leader in the field of retina, Dr. Ehsan Rahimi. Dr. Rahimi is the Adjunct Associate Clinical Professor of Ophthalmology at Stanford University and the Chief of Retina at Palo Alto Medical Foundation. Dr. Rahimi, thanks for joining us today.
Pradeep, anything for you. It's great to see you, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. Should be a fun one.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about kind of what got you into retina. We all have our reasons. It's funny, we all have similar reasons, but tell us about your path.
Yeah, I was a third year rising into fourth year medical student at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And he was our basic science curriculum sort of mentors. His name was Frank Kretzer. He's now since passed. Rest in peace. He's been responsible for many previous Baylor students going into ophthalmology, actually. When you look across some of our colleagues in the field, you'll find a lot of them potentially at one point or another had Baylor as a stop. And Frank is a large reason for that. He was particularly close to me. And I remember having done all my rotations. And I was one of those med students that I kind of liked everything. I liked any rotation I was on, and I didn't particularly love anything at the same time too, and I didn't really hate anything either. So you just kind of like going through the motions, doing all these rotations, and you know, for the end of third year, you're supposed to decide what you want to do at this point. And I remember I had a kind of a one-on-one meeting with Frank. I kind of reached out to him saying I'm kind of confused. I'm not quite sure what I want to do. And he was always very passionate about ophthalmology. A lot of his research. He did basic science research, was in like the field of ROP, for example. So he was just very passionate about the anatomy of the eye and all the different conditions, especially retina. So he was strongly advocating that I should look into ophthalmology and specifically retina. And I said, you know, that's great, but like you have such limited time. You have to decide early, as you know, with ophthalmology, get your applications out. You should have research. And at that time, there wasn't even any space in the clinical elective ophthalmology track. So He this big favor he did to me. He kind of worked privately with some of the attendings at Baylor and just kind of did this makeshift rotation for me, just for me, actually. And I'll never forget this. You know, we all have our aha moment, but the very first day of this rotation, I was assigned to be with Dr. Eric Holtz. He's also a well-known guy in retina. He actually, at the time, was the chief of retina over at Baylor and the head of their fellowship program. He's now, I think, since in private practice in Houston. He was a phenomenal teacher. He's one of those people, you know, when you decide you want to go into a field, half of that reason, maybe is obviously you're interested in the subject matter or whatnot, but half of it is the people you're with. And if you vibe with them, if you see that they really are passionate about what they're doing, they love their job, they love interacting with their patients and being around trainees and staff, that is infectious. And that was my experience with them. And the very first day of that rotation, I remember I showed up and I was supposed to go straight to the OR and, you know, walk into the retina OR. And the very first thing you're seeing is him peeling ILM around the macular hole. Like that was my aha moment. It's just like, you know, that sanctity of like, this idea that we are not supposed to be here. You know, we are not supposed to be doing something like this in such a delicate space of the eye. And yet here we are. And we do this every day. We do this multiple times a week. And it's just, it kind of gives me chills. It's we're so very, very fortunate to do what we do.
Yeah, no, it's a humbling specialty, ophthalmology in general, the impact we can have on people's lives. But I had that same moment too. I was I didn't know I wanted to do retina until I was a second year in residency. But when I did see the fundus for the first time in the operating room, it really just blew my mind. And people play such a huge role in where we end up in our lives. Definitely, I think that I've heard that from multiple people, and it was certainly true for me that I was drawn to ophthalmology because of the people who were there. They seemed happy, and certainly their personalities were similar to mine. And so you kind of gravitate to the people in the field, I think, just as much as the science and the medicine of it.
I remember, yeah, like had I not done ophthalmology, I was leaning heavily towards, and we've heard our colleagues say this, neurosurgery. Yet I was on those rotations, and I'm still friends with some of my colleagues who are in the field, but just don't come across as being too happy at times, and overworked, stressed, and just at least for one reason or another, wasn't the most positive experience for me as a medical student. And I think the beauty of retina, and I've heard a lot of our colleagues say this, is it's that beautiful kind of marriage of ophthalmology and actually like the things one would have sought after with neurosurgery. Because really, we tell our patients this all the time, the retina is really not so much a part of your eye, it's really more a part of your brain. But we
Yes.
get kind of the best of both worlds in
That's
being in
right. I
our
was going to
field.
say you are a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that brought you into ophthalmology. And so did you know that you were going to go into retina as soon as you when you hit residency?
Yeah, so like you said, you decide on retina and residency. I mean, for me, my initial exposure into ophthalmology was that retina rotation, and that's I knew I wanted to do retina. Everything else was a means to get to this end game. Like, and then obviously, I loved all the other aspects of ophthalmology. I loved cataract surgery. I loved, we're at UCLA. I loved my experience on peds and strabismus with Federico Velez. Like, just because we didn't go into a particular subspecialty didn't mean we didn't find great value and mentorship, companionship from the variety of attendings that we came across. But yeah, I mean, for me, I was retina from the start. There was no change in my mind.
Well, we're all better off for it. And you've it's funny, you've trained at some really amazing institutions. I mean, started at Baylor, came to UCLA, then went on to Wills. Now you're at Stanford. Very different from my path, actually. I've been at UCLA my entire life, and I've loved my time at UCLA. But there's so much value, I think, in being at different institutions and kind of learning how medicine is practiced in different groups, or these silos of information that are really kind of hard for us to break through. And you've really benefited, I think, from learning from great people at different institutions. And now you're the educator at a great institution. So tell us about, was that a conscious decision? How you've benefited from that, and what you've taken away from each of these places that you've been at.
Yes, it's a great question, and as you said, you and I have had very, very different paths to get to kind of where we are. And I think there's pros and cons of both, honestly. And I think that really one of the key differences just comes down to relationships that you build ultimately in the field that you're going to go into. On one aspect, there's the breadth versus depth, if you will. So for me, I've been in all these different institutions. I've built relationships with, let's look within our field of retina with colleagues that are at Baylor, UCLA, Wills, Stanford. So you think about the breadth of your network is it gets particularly large. And I think that can, pay itself forward in so many different ways when you're talking about early career development, being sought after for various opportunities, be it, speaking, lectureship, research participation, industry type of stuff, as I'm sure we'll discuss. Just having your network, your social network in your field to be as large and as heterogeneous as possible, that's a huge advantage. But by that same token, it's not to say that someone else who stayed in a single institution or two is at a disadvantage. That's the depth argument to be made. You stay in a place and you form and forge these very, very powerful, long-lasting, multi-year relationships. And I'm sure you can speak to that with some mentors of yours who you're extremely close to from having been with them probably for close to a decade plus of your life right now, right? So there's no right or wrong answer to how to go about this, but I will recall a quote from Gary Holland, who was, he's one of our mentors in residency at UCLA. He strongly encouraged residents to go elsewhere. And I'll never forget, he kind of had sat down with us when we were rotating with them, and he said, "I don't care if UCLA is the number one fellowship in the world for whatever you go into, go to number two if you can go somewhere else, just to expand your horizon, see how things, how medicine, how your field is practiced differently, a different institution under the, other brilliant minds in the field. And you will get, exponential growth that way. What you've learned here at UCLA will, it will not evade you. You won't forget it. It is a building block for the next place you go to." And he couldn't have been more right than that. And I do credit him partly with my decision to leave, whether he knows that or not. Because I was, as was very torn. I really did actually want to stay in UCLA. Like, my heart is there in Southern California. But, all things work out as they should.
Yeah, no, I remember that time actually, and hoping that you would stay at UCLA, but you're obviously you made some great choices going forward with training, and then you had to make an important choice when you were choosing your first job. And so, many of the people who are watching this are maybe they're in medical school, residency, fellowship. Maybe they're already in practice, they're thinking about going to a different job, and kind of that thought process of, well, how do you choose, where you're going to, try to grow some roots, and practice hopefully for a long period of time. Tell us about that process for you, if you can think back to that, when you're finishing fellowship, you're thinking about where you want to be geographically, where you want to practice, what kind of setting. Tell us about all those factors that played into your decision.
Yes, and I'll tell you kind of where my mind was, but also, and I'll turn it into a way when I mentor a lot of our fellows on this part of their career, how I advise them. I think you can seek out certain things. You're not going to get everything right off the bat, whether it's, you want location, job type, be it academics, private practice, you're looking for optimal compensation or work schedule. You're not going to get everything off the bat. It just doesn't exist anymore. And the other kind of asterisk I put to this is the job environment is drastically different than when you and I graduated. It's just a totally different ball game now. Private equity is now, entered the chat, so to speak, and the job market dynamics are very, very different for a lot of these trainees coming out. I still think certain ground truths are relevant. Number one being, if one is relatively not sure what they want, I think there's power and strength in staying in academics for no other reason than just let your star burn a little brighter. If you aren't sure what you want to do, and you decide to, I don't know, take a random job elsewhere, it becomes very easy to fall off the map. And maybe that's what some people want. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're someone who's trying to, you're a young clinician trying to develop your career professionally, you want to be involved with the society's research, present at meetings and whatnot, you need to stay visible, you need to stay active, you need to stay engaged. And being in an academic position is probably the best way to do that early on in your career. And it's challenging because when you're coming out, you're just trying to learn how to, like, walk, and talk and do surgery. You just don't have time for all these other things. But at least that type of environment is optimal to allow you for professional development, so that, again, you can stay visible, you can stay relevant. And if you decide after a couple of years it's not right for you, then you would pursue an opportunity elsewhere. So for myself, I was actually quite unsure what I wanted to do. I was looking at academic jobs, private jobs. I think for us, we kind of prioritized location. And at the time, I thought I would end up back in Texas, where I was in medical school in Houston. And just for a variety of reasons, it just didn't seem optimal as the job start date got closer, large part due to family need. My family is in Southern California, and a desire to be on the West Coast. And so, ultimately, if you know you want to be somewhere, I think the best choice you can do is just bite the bullet, prioritize being in that location and go there. Whether it's in my situation, finding the best job that would be available there. But again, this is where I think it's different now, and market dynamics are different for some of our fellows graduating. You may just be better off starting your own practice. I tell fellows that a lot, and I think it's actually going to become a thing again. We're going to see a resurgence of smaller, one and two doctor practices as this PE cycle kind of closes off. And I also think it's going to be more popular to seek after academic positions again, because a lot of our fellows coming out, they're not particularly enthusiastic about just, joining groups that are PE owned, where they don't necessarily, retain any equity stake or ownership. And so job options become a little bit more limited, if you will. So it's a challenging market. I try to help advocate for our fellows, and just seeing their own patterns in terms of the practices that they choose to join. I think it's just a very different ball game. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that yourself.
Yeah, no, I think all of the things that you mentioned are really important. For what I always tell our fellows is, it's just like we talked about earlier, your path into ophthalmology, my path into ophthalmology was largely based on the people, and I gravitated towards the right people. That's really important. When you're thinking about your job, not only you have to take into account, a significant other, where their profession, where they want to be, geographically, where, if you're going to be close to family or not. But also it's really important to really think about the people that you're going to be working with. You want to be with high integrity people, that you would want to spend time with. These are going to be, this is like your second family. You'll probably spend more time in some days, some weeks you'll spend more time with your work colleagues than you might with your own family. And so you never want to be in a situation, I think, where you just don't philosophically align with the people that you're working with, and so that's hard. That's really hard to assess, because when you're choosing a job, I mean, you'll make a number of trips and you'll try to do your due diligence, but at the end of the day, it's hard to make that determination. Just like it's, hard to choose a partner for life. You've spent a lot of time deciding on that and figuring out if the person's right for you, and we are not afforded that same opportunity for our job. But that's where, the advice of mentors, people who may know the doctors in that practice. Maybe there may be even people who are alumni of your training program. So you have some degree of understanding that you're philosophically aligned in how you take care of people and the ethics and the
Yeah,
integrity. Those are
I
really
think
important.
I'd like to just a shout out to Steve Schwartz. This speaks to the differences in fellowship programs. Steve, as you and I know, he's so like intimately involved with helping you guys as fellows go where you want to go, and he plays such a critical role. And as a resident, when I got to see that, you just assume that that's normal. That's what fellowship director should do for you. He's in the minority. He is the minority, especially when you go other places and you see just how involved and how much of an advocate he is to help you guys secure the jobs you want. You guys are very, very lucky and fortunate. Majority of fellowships are not like that at all. And sometimes you're the one doing a lot of that legwork yourself as a fellow. And it's tough when you have training and cases and surgeries, and then you're supposed to go reach out to practices, talk to them, interview, kind of advocate for yourself. So you guys are very fortunate.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I'm a direct beneficiary of Steve's guidance for multiple stages of my life, and what I would say that's really special about him, and I try to incorporate this into my own way of mentoring fellows, is that it's not really about what I want for a fellow. It's really trying to help the fellow get what they want, and Steve never had any designs of what my fellows have to go into academic positions, or they have to be at these particular places. He really was interested in helping open doors for whatever his fellows were interested in pursuing. And so that's also a very unique aspect of his role as a mentor for myself and for so many other fellows before me.
Absolutely. I think that's very forward thinking to be that way, because that is not necessarily the mindset at other institutions, especially, for example, if they're academic based. It almost feels like they're incentivized. They have to put their fellows into academic career tracks, get your K-1s, do your research. But I like the way you said it. With Stephen as fellows, it's not about what I want for this person. It's what's best for their life. And there's so many different, paths to take after fellowship for someone in training. So.
You mentioned earlier getting involved, staying engaged. And one of the things that has really been remarkable to me is how involved you've been in industry, actually, at a very early stage in your career, and you've really grown quite a bit. I mean, you're a key opinion leader for multiple companies. You've collaborated with companies from Regeneron to Google. I mean, really have had a huge impact on a number of companies, many of which are household names, and others that will be probably in the future. So, I guess my question is how did you get involved? And for young doctors who also want to get involved, what's your advice for how they can also pursue that path?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. This is where I kind of really have to tip the cap to the mentors I had, fellowship at Wells. Some of the guys there leading KOLs in the field, people like Carl Regillo, Alan Ho, just were very, very big supportive voices of us during fellowship when we expressed interest in kind of carving out that type of a career choice for ourselves. And to that end, I thought they were phenomenal mentors. I could see myself, one day kind of being in their shoes wherever I ended up. And so at least the first thing I'd say is if that's what you're interested in, you need to somewhat, be vocal about it. Not necessarily aggressive, but you need to tell the mentors, the people you trust, the people you know who are going to have your back and be in your corner that, this is something I'm interested in. I see that play out kind of now that roles are reversed, and I'm the guy in that position now as a mentor for fellows and residents, and I tell them that these are things you're interested in, and they do. They tell me, hey, how do you get involved in, advisory boards or consulting? And as these opportunities come, your time becomes more valuable. I tell the fellows that all the time. The most valuable asset you actually have in this world, whether this applies to medicine, your career, or otherwise, is time. And it's one of those things like you say, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, duh, of course. But at some point, you really appreciate what that means. And at least in the context of this conversation, I don't have time to just say yes to everything. It's one of the toughest things is starting to say no. And eventually, we all will get to that phase of our careers. But when that does happen for me, when I see an opportunity that I otherwise would have liked, but I just had to prioritize other things, well, guess what? Other names pop up in my head, people that I'm close to, people in my circle of friends, people I know and I can vouch for, some of the bright young minds that are my trainees coming out that have said that they're interested in kind of following in a similar path. I start to push their name. And that's how a name can start to enter the circle of discussion on the industry side. And all you need is a shot, all you need is a chance. You get invited to something, you do a good job, and people start to they remember who you are, they remember how you did, and then just the opportunities start gradually coming. But you have to be available. You have to again let those who mentor you and support you know that you're potentially interested in. The next aspect to that, I would say, is and this is for someone in training to take advantage of, is express this and get to know your industry people where you're training. So that they can already start advocating for you while you're still in fellowship. And let's just take, Wills, for example. Namrata Saroj is just, she's very well known, in our field on the industry side. She was just such an incredible friend and mentor to me. And she was always kind of like promoting me. At the time, she was over at Regeneron. And again, I got to know Namrata just through fellowship at Wills. She was particularly close with Alan and Carl. And so they spoke highly of me. I expressed interest in kind of working and engaging with industry. And that's great because that relationship already exists in the context of your fellowship. Now think about going to a random new job. Now you got to start thinking, who are the MSLs here? Who are the TLLs here? By the way, that's a whole different alphabet soup that we don't learn in fellowship, but that it behooves you to be aware of who are the MSLs, who are the TLLs in these various companies in your region, and you want to meet these people and make yourself again available. They want to kind of stop by, say hi, introduce themselves, get to know you. And you're not, you nor them are really expecting anything in return. But when you kind of set that stage before you leave fellowship with the established infrastructure that's already there, like when I came out to California, Namrata was already contacting the Regeneron people. Like, hey, he's coming here. This guy's really good. He's done great at Wills. You should meet him. Then your name's already popping up on people's radars. So I'd say again, number one, you got to express that interest to the mentors that you have. Don't just expect that they're gonna just, say, oh, I'm gonna just give this to this person. Number two, you want to simultaneously be expressing that to, advocates of yours on the industry side. Number three, I mean, and we touched on this earlier with the job. Part of what you said, Pradeep, is the reason why I came back to California and the reason I wanted to be in the Bay Area. I wanted to be around an innovation hub. That was intentional to come here and be in Silicon Valley. Like every day, the people that we're around, whether it's at my primary location in Palo Alto, through my adjunct appointment at Stanford, the colleagues that were around doing just amazing, incredible research, the interface and overlay with technology with Silicon Valley here. I think that's, we all agree, is one of the things that makes Retina so cool. It's so disruptive because it's not just medicine. It's not just surgery. It's diagnostics, it's imaging, it's technology. It's going to be AI. It's just this beautiful harmony of all these things. And to me, what better place to be in practice in the country than here in the Bay Area? And I think if you talk to, a lot of our specialists, we have a, particularly congested market here, but you'll see a lot of the retina docs up here have are like-minded in that regard. They intentionally chose to be here. And I think it's for the things outside of medicine. It's for the opportunities for R&D and research and innovation as well too. And the last part I just tell you is honestly, it's just some dumb luck. You mentioned Google and I kind of worked with that team at the very early nascent stages when they were talking about doing AI-based autonomous screening for diabetic retinopathy images. I remember back then it was literally just a small table, myself, project managers, a couple engineers talking about how this would go. I just got that opportunity randomly because a med school colleague of mine who happened to go to undergrad with the lead project manager was like, hey, they need a retina specialist. I know you're a retina specialist and you're in the Bay Area. Do you want to work on this? And I was like, I didn't even know what it was at the time. I was like, Google, sure, that sounds pretty cool. But it ended up being a kind of a multi-year project and got to present quite a bit on it and share our knowledge with the field. And a lot of that's obviously just exploded when you start talking about AI and medicine and ophthalmology and especially retina.
Yeah, no, that's really great advice. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your research activities because you are, in addition to all of the many many ways in which you're a leader in retina, and in ophthalmology in general, you're also a tremendously prolific researcher. And I want to start back when you were a resident. Many people may not know this, but you basically discovered PAM, paracentral acute middle maculopathy. For those who are unfamiliar with it, should definitely read those early papers. Tell us about how you noticed this, I suppose, and what it was like to sort of discover a new ophthalmologic finding, which actually has really broad-ranging implications for a variety of ophthalmic conditions. It's really, it must have been extremely exciting. And just tell us about that process.
Yeah, I mean, first things, when you talk about credit for something, I want to credit our co-residents who were on these rotations. I remember the very first patient with Pam we saw was on our VA block. Like Louis Sabar was there and Rob Beardsley. And these kind of things end up being more of a team effort in terms of observation. Then you need a captain of the ship who's going to help kind of drive this story and get it out there. And that's where, Dr. Saraf, another kind of critical mentor to my career, especially in those early stages, was just so valuable in helping us guide this and kind of narrate the story. And fortunately, he's somebody I wrote a lot with, especially when you're a resident. You don't really know what's relevant or not. This is where I think having great mentors is valuable, especially if you're looking to be someone who contributes to the literature and writes. Writing and scientific prose is just it's a totally different ballgame. Writing and for ophthalmology and for retina journals is a totally different ballgame than that. And so having someone who is already considered a leader in the field, and Saraf is a superstar. He's one of the preeminent KOLs. I feel like even at that time he was, but just over the course of this last decade, as he's just continues to ascend. He's like the modern day gas, if you will. That's like just how respected David is. But having him as a mentor, I just remember all the times we had so many revisions of that seminal paper, the one that was in JAMA Ophthalmology. We'd meet, we went to lunch, we talked about this and that. What are we going to call it? What is it? You got to have something catchy, something that people are going to remember. And as a resident, then I'm like, this guy's very passionate about this stuff. Like, I don't know where this is honestly going to go. Here we are now, there's just countless hours put in this. And that's one thing I think I really took from David is putting you have to understand that you're putting your name on on this paper. Once it goes out there, this is forever. Kind of putting your reputation on the line here. And he was very, very nuanced with reviewing papers, revisions, changes. No, I don't like that. Let's talk about this. Let's put this in. Let's include this paper. You know what? I think we need to maybe include these authors and their contributions to the field too. It's sort of a scientific method in of itself. And I think actually to this day, I do things and I run projects the same exact way that David did with me. And that's how he taught me. So I'm very grateful to him for that.
No, that's great. And sort of fast forwarding from the very, those beginning days of PAM, now all the way to where you are now, you've such, I'm always impressed by how creative your scientific questions are in your projects. And one project that you have that I think you'll be presenting at ASRS this year, looking at cannabinoid use, and the risk for PVR. So, I guess my question is where do you get your inspiration for these projects?
Oh, and you should talk to my wife. Like, just I think loathes all the times we're like just doing something unrelated to work, and then I'm randomly saying, like, this is a good question for Trinetics, right? This is a good question that we should run this in the platform and see. It's just I don't know. My mind is part of my mind is always, worrying, and random thoughts come up. In terms of the cannabis one, for example, thank you for saying that they're creative. I try to think of like salient questions that I feel like we have gaps that potentially new types of research can help. And so, a lot of the research us and my colleagues at Stanford, Prithvi Mrithunjaya, Karen Way, and others, we have an awesome team that we work with there, was. I get asked a lot from patients these days, at least depending on how you counsel preoperatively for a retinal detachment repair. Like, what single surgery success rate? Well, 9 out of 10 patients don't need additional surgery. 1 out of 10 may, and the leading cause of failure is the scar tissue formation, which we know as PVR. Well, what are some of the risk factors for it? He's like, duration of the detachment, severity of it, et cetera. But of course, one of the most modifiable risk factors is smoking. And I can't tell you how many times people are like, oh, what about cannabis? What if I'm smoking or what if I'm taking gummies? The reality is there's nothing in our literature on this at all. That's very interesting to me. And that's a question that came up, and we can ask that. This database Trinetics that we work with, we have means of verifying patients are potentially, like in this case, using the substance. And just due to the sheer volume that you have at your disposal, like the Trinetics database, it's basically large aggregate EHR data from over 120 institutions, over 250 million patient lives there, right? So you can really fine-tune and construct these cohorts of investigational patients that you want to investigate the effect of something. In this case, it was cannabis. But what's really powerful then is it's called propensity score matching. You're essentially comparing them to this synthetic control. And because of the sheer volume of patients, you can actually do that. You can essentially match each of these patients to a control and control for a variety of factors, patient characteristics, age, gender, ethnicity, so on and so forth, ocular characteristics, pseudophakic myopia, whether vitreous hemorrhage is present or not, then social characteristics. Are they a smoker or not, or certain medication use? Then you kind of create in the synthetic control, then you can kind of check your outcomes. And the reason I wanted to do that again is so I can at least let patients know, we did this study and it's not definitive. Nothing in these aggregate EHR studies is definitive. And that's an important take-home point I always emphasize. These are more, they're like heat-seeking. They're showing you like a heat map where a trend is, where something should be investigated further with prospective studies to follow up and verify those findings. But the signals here are obviously very interesting. I think one thing I'd like to say, though, is there's a, unfortunately, when the media got this article, and there was also an editorial that ran in JAMA simultaneously, and it was framed as if cannabis reduces the risk of PBR. There's a very fine line here in terms of what we were actually trying to accomplish. And again, this was my David Seraph. So Amar Al-Soudi is our first author. He is now a first year fellow at Beaumont, and I'm sure he could tell you if you ever have a drink with him. Like, I was harassing the team up and down. Like, we need to be very careful with what our messaging here is. It's not that I think cannabis is taboo or not, but I think there's a very fine line in saying cannabis risk reduces PBR, which, that's at least what was shown statistically or numerically, versus what I think the actual message here was, which is cannabis use did not increase the risk of PBR similar to, tobacco or nicotine. But, unfortunately, and the media sees it, it's kind of like ends up being like a sexy kind of headline type topic, and they kind of run with it. So, but yeah, we're excited about that paper, and I think it's an important topic to address. There was actually some other studies that were done in JAMA, just the main JAMA journal, for example. I think there was a study out of I want to say out of Harvard, one of the maybe it was Beth Israel, one of the hospitals there, where patients actually do not voluntarily offer that they use cannabis, again, just for fear that this is a taboo topic. And I don't necessarily think that it should, but it's just one of those things that should cross our mind when we're preoperatively counseling our patients.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. I think that these big data sets that we have access to can, as you say, kind of help identify trends in relatively short order. I mean, you can get answers to questions, at least high level, whether or not it's something to pursue pretty quickly. It's kind of amazing, By the same token, the data is very messy, and so you hope that just the sheer volume of patients kind of helps to get you through the noise of the data set. But in your opinion, I mean, where do you see this going? I mean, there's every everywhere I see everywhere I look, I see these big data sets. You mentioned TrinetX. There's many others, of course. So where do you see this going? How can we make this better? What's the future of these big data sets? Because that really is kind of where a lot of healthcare is going right now in general, is aggregation of data and trying to find answers to scientific questions, or maybe finding opportunities for new drug development. And there's all sorts of different applications of these big data sets. So, but w you know, the, this shortcoming is I think a real issue. So, what do you think is that? What does the future hold in this space?
Yeah, I think obviously it's undeniable the power of volume. Acknowledging, as you said, there's significant shortcomings. Like, for whatever we gain in terms of, seeing these just massive numbers and seeing what essentially to me is definitive trends, you lack in clarity. We cannot dissect down and get granular data. And there's value to both, right? If you think about different types of research, you could have something as simple as a case report, a case series, prospective trials, observational studies, things where you can get granular information, but none of them can even come close to comparing to the volume you get in some of these studies. We had a we had a paper. It was an AJO on, again, another interesting question I had was, we always talk about retinal artery occlusion and morbidity mortality risk, but nobody ever really asks about vein occlusion. Isn't that the one we also equate to being sort of like a stroke in your eye too, and have similar underlying cardiovascular risk factors? And so we wanted to pose that to the system. And the volume of long-term follow-up you had here, over 40,000 patients, is like, you're never going to get that in the kind of trial. So it's about learning what is its role in research. It's none of these are standalone definitive end-all be-all. I mean, obviously level one evidence is prospective trials. There's, that's definitive, but I view these other types of research as being complementary. And that's what I mentioned earlier, which was, when I take in these trinetics type studies, first off, I tell when medical students, residents, or fellows are working on this, these should not be hypothesis generating. You shouldn't be like, oh, I think this could be like a random association with, this medicine and that thing. Let's just see if that actually exists. You're going to get a lot of false positives when you do that. So what I'm typically looking for, something that's already grounded in basic science literature, already has some observational studies, something that the community has agreed upon is potentially a legitimate association, then that we're trying to like expound on and look at it in much larger numbers. I think that's a more sound process to approach big data, rather than, so it should not be necessarily hypothesis generating, but I think it's more like hypothesis validating in a ways. But even when it's validated, it's not definitive. And what needs to follow ultimately is, if it's something of interest, you should follow up with something that's a prospective trial. Another good example is, again, Amar, he was phenomenal for a lot of our papers. We have another one looking at immunosuppression to help potentially prevent PVR as well too. And that type of a project, again, is not necessarily hypothesis generating, because there's a litany of basic science research suggesting that various classes of immunosuppressants could be potentially beneficial for PVR. But what we did in this particular case is tested various classes on PVR outcomes and see which ones look particularly promising. And as a fellow now, Amrit plans to kind of carry that forward and kind of set up some research during fellowship to investigate this further. And I think that's more sound research, right? You shouldn't just be just doing a ton of, I'm gonna do a ton of trinetic studies and publish it and whatever, and that's the end of it. I don't think that ends up being very valuable.
No, that's a good point. And yeah, I think it is really opening up some new avenues for further investigation, and there's certainly a lot of value there. It'll be interesting to see how our EHRs evolve, how our data aggregation evolves, and how we might be able to leverage these huge data sets to get even more granular answers to some of these questions. Any thoughts on that?
Well, we've talked about this before, so and I think this is really where this is going to head. If this is going to be valuable research, it has to tie into individual patient outcomes. We have to be able to, again, pull it all together. But when we do need to slice and dice it and see the individual patient, we should be able to, whether that's tying in their ancillary imaging, OCT findings, fluorescein angiogram, specific ocular, examination outcomes, et cetera. You got to be able to do that. If you do that, then you're potentially creating what is a very powerful research tool. And obviously, this has been, the companies in the field that are interested in this has been their number one priority, is to see how this can be done. And we've seen examples of this in other fields of medicine. First thing that comes to mind is obviously Flatiron in the oncology space, but if you actually are able to, wield this large volume of data, but be able to like get granular insight, then that is, I think, going to be potentially game changing. But that is a tricky lock to pick.
Right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit to back to education. This is obvious. Retina Rounds is primarily a platform to learn about surgery, and you are an outstanding surgeon, but also an outstanding surgical educator. And we've seen some great cases this past week where I think we've all had a chance to learn from your experience, from your fellow's experience. Tell us a few pearls that you always like to impart on your fellows so that they can succeed surgically, both during fellowship and obviously more important beyond fellowship?
Okay. I have one for before coming into fellowship and one after. I think I tell all the fellows this when they're starting, I want you to just envision yourself. There should be two tracks of yourself throughout these next 2 years. Especially this applies, I think, being in the operating room. On one track in whatever program you're in, you may have, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 10. Stanford, they have like, what is it now? 17 different attendings that you may be working with. And everybody's different. Some attendings are a little more OCD and nuanced. Others are a lot more lax, let you do things however you want. Some things want things done a particular way, their way. That's the way I am. I want to trust that my fellows are operating like an extension of myself when I'm with them. And that's kind of the standard that I hold them to. But not everyone's like that, and that's fine. But as a fellow coming into training, I think you need to envision these two tracks. On one track, you're trying to be a great fellow. And however you need to do this, do it. And for me, it was this. When I was a fellow at Wales, I had this massive, Google document on my laptop, and I created documents for every single attending that I work with. And I'd bring it to the OR on my laptop. And after every case, if I got a pearl from them, if I saw the way they did something, if they critiqued me on something that I did that they took note of or wanted me to correct, I immediately after the case went put that in that document. And it's easy for us to say that, oh, I'll remember these things and come back to it at the end of the day. At the end of the day, you go home, you're tired, you forgot half of the stuff, you fall asleep, you're like, I'll do it tomorrow, and then you already forgot everything, and it's just not even out of sight, out of mind. So I was very intentional. Have that laptop with me, that document open, and fill out all these particular details about these attendings that I work with, what they liked, what they didn't like. And I still have that document. And in fact, I used that document a lot when I was starting up in practice. I felt like I had my teachers there as coaching me by my side. That's beyond the point. The point is, that's how you really stand out as a good fellow. Whether you realize it or not, as a trainee, you're always being compared. It's not intentional. Like my experience with fellows is being compared directly to all the ones that preceded them. And when you have particularly great fellows, that becomes the standard in your mind. And I think this is a great way for trainees to really stand out, where they go is learn and actually intentionally learn the nuances of all the different attendings you work with, and intentionally be that way when you're with them. It really makes a big difference to me as an educator when I don't have to repeat myself over and over and over why I do this or why I don't do that, and you shouldn't do this. And especially as an educator, I think one of the things that I don't particularly love is when trainees say, but Dr. So-and-so does it that way. I don't particularly love hearing that. I'm gonna let it slide because I want to be nice to you, but I prefer that when you're with me, you do things my way. And in that document, whatever fellow with Dr. Emmett's gonna say that then, right? And so that's one track of being a great fellow, is trying your best to be a chameleon and emulate each of those attendings, especially when you're in the OR with them. That shows, I think, the utmost respect for them, their practice, and their patients. But the second track is really, I think, the final product, which is going to be you at the end of your fellowship. It's going to be subconsciously this blend of all of these attendings. And you will pick, as a fellow, the things you like from, I didn't like what Rahimi did here, but I do like these things, and I prefer something Dr. Mithunjaya does here and that. And that final product is this beautiful melody of all the different attendings you work with and all their varied experiences and their training backgrounds. But I think too many times fellows just are worried about that second track. You don't need to be worried about it. That happens over time, and they ignore the first, which is how to really stand out on an individual basis for these attendings. That's a long-winded answer to the first, but the second, I don't know if you have something to say there.
I think that just to talk about the first part of that first track, I think really the key thing that hopefully some of our younger listeners can get from that is that learning how to be a great surgeon, or learning surgery, period, is a two-way street, right? It's not, I'm going to show up, I'm a blank slate to the operating room, and now Dr. Rahimi, show me how I can be teach me how to become a great doctor. There's definitely a part of that. That's what your mentors are there for. They're there to teach you and guide you and give you tips and show you different ways of tackling problems. But really, to take it to the next level, it requires the trainee also to be invested in that process of taking notes, as you said, taking feedback, and not just hearing it, but really doing something about it. And I think your word, being intentional about it, is absolutely right. That has to be the approach, and that's really what I've noticed is that the difference between, good fellows or good trainees and those who really are great, who become the standard by which all other trainees are compared.
Absolutely.
So that's one thing I just would hope that some of our younger listeners would really get from that, those pearls, is that it really is very much a two-way street. And the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it.
Absolutely. And then when my fellows are, getting toward, let's say when they're in second year and coming down that home stretch, it always sounds kind of odd to say it, but in hindsight, I wish I watched my mentors operate more down the home stretch, which is kind of weird. It's like, your last 6 months of your fellowship, you're this like lean, mean retina machine. You're just doing cases nonstop. Like that's what Will's second year was, is every single day you're just operating, operating, operating. You're like operating until you're sick of it. And you feel great at surgery. It's good. That's a good thing. But that is actually the best opportunity. And it's your last opportunity to step back and watch. And it's watching becomes very different at that stage than when you're starting fellowship. You're starting fellowship, you don't really have any foundation. You don't know what the heck is going on. You don't know what you're paying attention to. You're very just like focused on inside the eye, what the attending is doing. You're just like trying to like be present. It's very different to then come back and watch the different attendings operate once you have a foundation and you know what's going on, because you really pay attention, I say, to the peripherals. Obviously, you see what's going on in the eye. Then you start paying attention to how the attending's holding their hand on the wrist first. How are they maneuvering instruments? How are they exactly holding it? How are they positioned? How are they postured? What are the next steps of surgery that they're always preemptively thinking about? Once you have a foundation, there is exponential learning observation. If you think about it, this is your last chance to watch these people who you essentially, trained under and idolized, and they're your mentors, to get to see how they do their craft before you're going to be unleashed into the world and do it on your own. So take advantage of that. I did it a couple of times, but I really wished I did it more. When, as attendings, we always want to let you get fellows, get their numbers and do this. But I think one thing that would really kind of surprise me, I kind of wish I did more, is like, no, you know what, Dr. So-and-so, you do it. I want to watch you, see how you do this time. And then for when my fellows are graduating, and I've had a lot of these conversations, I'm sure you have too. They're messaging you about their first PVR complications or how to handle these type of things. And I remember being in that position and reaching out to my mentors. And it's honestly, it's personally devastating the first few times these things happen, when complications happen to you, because they're not your patients. They're under your care. They're going to be with you for the duration, of the time that you're here being their provider. And it's just this reminder that the operating room is the great equalizer, is what I always say. Like, you're never as good as you think you are. You're never as bad as you think you are. That you're never as good as you think you are part, I think, becomes really relevant second year of fellowship, because that's again when you're hitting your stride, firing on all cylinders. You think you're really good. That's always when mistakes happen. Dumb, preventable mistakes always happen, usually around January or second year of fellowship, from overconfidence. So you're never as good as you think you are. And then conversely, with the you're never as bad as you think you are, like, complications are going to happen. We're all going to get PVR. We're all eventually going to get our first endophthalmitis. But I think the weight of it when you're just starting out is so consequential. And if you think about it, it's because your numerator is one, but your denominator is still so low. Talk about post-injection endophthalmitis risk, 1 in 10,000. Well, shoot, what happens if you got it after your 100th injection? It can happen. This is just the law of numbers. It doesn't mean that you suck and you need to change how you're doing everything. It's just, no, you just haven't had enough time for all the ebbs and flows to even out. Same thing with surgery. You may get PVR after your fifth RD. You're like, oh, my reattachment rate's 20%. You may even get two of them in your first 10. It doesn't mean that your training is wrong and you're not a good surgeon and you should doubt yourself. Of course not. But these are the thoughts that will creep into the young surgeon's mind. And at least that's the thing I tell. I usually end up having this conversation again post-fellowship is just, trust your training, ride it out. Just always remember, OR is the great equalizer. You're never as good as you think you are, and you're never as bad as you fear you are.
Yeah, that's very true. Very, very true. And I think going also again back to your first pearl, which is you can't change things that have not gone well, right? You can't undo the past. But what you can do is you can learn from it, you can grow from it. There's all sorts of different ways that you can learn from an adverse outcome, whether it's the technical aspects of the surgery, or maybe it was the communication with the patient or the family or whatever it may be. There's a lot of different ways to learn and grow from that experience, and that's how you get better. You have to you probably learn a lot more from the failures than you do from the huge successes, and so
100%.
that's really
That's
important.
another thing I tell the fellows is our field, for better or worse, is a field of N of ones. Fellows always ask me, why do you do this and why do you do that? And I remember one case where something went wrong, and that's why I do what I do. And I think that's the beauty of our field. And I think at the same time, that's what terrifies so many other eye care providers about our field and why they didn't go into retina. It's just the weight of our surgery and the weight of our decisions that we do is just so consequential. This is sight. And if you ever talk to any of our patients, they will tell you just how important this is. Or what's funny is always, I always get a lot kick out of this. And when we're potentially dealing with other services, I'm sure you've had this happen, whom we may interface with in our careers. For access to things, maybe be it access to the operating room, you may deal with anesthesiologists or other services. It always feels like ophthalmology, gets the short end of the stick, or we're always kind of like fighting for relevancy. But when we're not is when something actually happens to somebody in those fields and they appreciate now and just understand how important what we do is. And I've had that happen a couple of times in my career, and it's just amazing. It's obviously nothing you ever would want to wish on somebody, but for these conditions that we take care of, the implications of them, this is just really serious stuff. And I think the gravity of that is honestly what makes this very rewarding. But I'm not going to lie, I have a lot of sleepless nights and always thinking about my patients and hoping they're well. And complications ultimately do happen, and it's our job to normalize that. And to be there for our patients and shepherd them through these processes. And that's what being a good doctor is all about. And I know you're the same way.
Well, Esan, I think that if anything, I hope our viewers can get a sense of how great of a doctor and a person that you are. You really are the sort of the entire package. You're a leader in research, surgery, education, innovation. But more important, I think, than all of that, which is really the most important thing to me, is that you're a great friend, and just a really a good person. So, thank you for all your friendship throughout all these years. Looking forward to more years to come, and thank you for all the contributions that you made to our field.
Thank you so much. I mean, obviously, right back at you. You've always been such a close friend and mentor to me. If I can just say here, like you were one of my first experiences in retina as a resident, us doing late night retinal detachment at Harbor County Hospital. That's where Angry Pradeep came out. But that just I think speaks to the. Just the value and what a special time of my life that was. People ask me, just those years at UCLA, I love them so much. We're all such a close group. You've to this day been such a good friend of mine, such a great mentor. And obviously, I don't even deserve to be on your show with the Titans in the field you guys speak with. But I'm very humbled and obviously excited to have done this. And I'm looking forward to seeing the final product.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.